This episode of Film Scene is being brought to you by our new Zazzle store. For logoed shirts, mugs, and stickers, go to zazzle.com/filmscene.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, it's showtime.
For beautiful, sunny Chicago, this is Film Scene, your source for classic movie chatter. I'm Tim Gordon, your host, and joining me today is co-host Karen Gordon.
Oh, did you get a Film Scene mug for Father's Day this year?
No, you didn't go shopping, did you?
What would I buy from my own Zazzle store?
Also joining us today is our special guest, Walter Gordon.
Wow.
Fresh off the plane from Germany.
That is correct.
That sounds totally made up.
Did you enjoy German theater at all?
Yes, we saw Berlin Symphony of a Great City at the Arsenal Cinema Potsdamer Platz.
Yeah, so is that a movie?
Yes, it's a silent film.
And is it a movie that's like playing there all the time or something?
No, they're like an art theater.
Oh. The Arsenal is a pretty brave title. I'll just leave that there. I guess it wasn't called the Blitzkrieg. Too soon? Too soon.
Not too soon for here, maybe for there.
Maybe for there.
So today we're going to count down our top 10 classic epic films. And we use a self-defining definition of the word classic, meaning pre-1970s.
You, not we.
We, the podcast.
Oh, okay.
And I guess we should maybe define what epic means in this case for film.
I was curious.
Is that the royal we?
Yeah, the royal we and the royal definition of epic as well.
Because if you're using epic as a literary definition, it's something completely different.
It's a long narrative poem.
Yeah, it's a long form narrative poem like the Homer's The Odyssey.
And it also has a hero.
Not necessarily.
But most often there is the epic hero.
I think by definition it does.
The epic hero is similar to the tragic hero, but it's not always tragic.
So that's not the case with these films. No hero.
But in some.
So, kind of, again, a self-definition for epic film. Something of substantial length. Most of these are over 3 hours long. A lot of times they're going to have some type of musical interlude at the beginning of the film, as well as an intermission, covering some kind of epic scope as well. Did you guys have any other...
Well, I mean, there's not very much else to say about it.
I wonder if there are such things as epic today. I mean, when you look at this list,
yes,
most of them seem pretty grandiose and classic. You think Cloud Atlas was epic?
It was very long.
Well, there's a lot of long movies that I would not quite classify as epic.
Well, I think some people would say something like Titanic.
Yeah.
It has to be over budget and, like, I mean, both Cloud Atlas and Titanic, way huge budget.
It's hard to have an independently made epic film.
Well, Cloud Atlas was independent.
In the most commercial sense possible.
Yeah, I'm talking about budget.
I mean, they had already had success with The Matrix. Is The Matrix an epic?
Yeah, but they didn't make anything good since then. It was independently funded.
Anymore, I would say that for the majority of time, what you're going to call epic today would be like a series of movies. Or like The Godfather,
I mean,
or Star Wars.
Lord of the Rings was
Lord of the Rings.
The closest thing.
Yeah.
Like if they had made that as a single film instead of
It was
of three.
A single film even, they were probably epic length. They were all almost like 3 hours long.
True.
So would you throw something like Star Wars into that, although those are standalone films that aren't necessarily of length, because over time you could sit and watch like 12 hours of it. Is that series an epic?
I think some people would call something like that epic because of what it's done in a cultural sense more than the movies themselves.
So epic itself can be defined as legendary, perhaps, as opposed to...
And having some sort of sustainability.
Okay.
But for these movies on this list, it started with something of substantial length and usually scope.
I want a big film.
Generally, you're going to have widescreen photography as an important aspect, too, but not always.
Okay, then.
So I have a couple of honorable mentions. Once Upon a Time in the West, Sergio Leone. The movie Giant, James Dean.
That's epic.
The Ten Commandments.
That's just long.
That is epic. This is like what most people would think of as epic.
John Wayne's The Alamo.
Nah.
And Dr. Zhivago.
I think that was funny because it has, what's the guy who works with Werner Herzog in it? The German guy, Klaus Kinski. He's there in a cameo, which I thought was funny.
In Dr. Zhivago?
Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't know that.
It's a very brief role.
At first I thought this was going to be one of those random trivia bits.
Well,
that guy, that German guy who worked with Werner Herzog.
Well, who's famous.
Colonel Klink.
Colonel Klink, yeah. I don't know. Wrong Werner.
So, starting off at number 10, we have from 1968, Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, starring Keir Dulla and Gary Lockwood. You guys probably know who did the voice of Hal, too. It's not on my list. I can't remember his name.
I do.
What's his name?
That was the question. I can tell you that Stanley Kubrick did some of the heavy breathing in the space.
Douglas Rain.
There you go. Douglas Rain. Did he do that heavy breathing on purpose? Or?
There's a weird kinkiness about him, I think. Just but he chubby. Did do it intentionally. Yeah, it was not just because he was.
Didn't we look up who did his voice before because we weren't sure if it was really a computer voice?
It was not a computer voice. It was a real person.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I mean.
So the gist of this movie is you have a space expedition that has a computer controlling the ship that kind of overrides its programming, goes a little crazy, and starts trying to kill people.
Yeah, that's about the
That doesn't sound like it's going to be epic in scope, but...
Well, what you described is only about the middle third of the movie, though.
Yeah, and I honestly think that explaining the plot to this is far more complex.
Well, and it starts off with this, you know, caveman type scenario, learning.
So the Australopithecines?
Excuse me?
They're just hominids of some sort.
Yes.
Learning how to hunt together and how to make fire and.
Well, not make fire, all use that kind tools. Of
stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, the fire kind of scared them to death, didn't it?
Was there even fire in it? I don't think there was.
I think so.
Yeah, I believe there was.
I just. Okay.
They learned how to barbecue.
And then it has a baffling ending that usually just makes people angry.
I've never seen anyone angry from it. I mean...
Well, you invest a lot of time in that film. You want payoff.
Yeah.
Well, I mean... Most
people want concrete
answers. At the premiere of it, Rock Hudson walked out and said, "What the hell did I just watch?"
And that's kind of how I feel when walking away from this film.
This was definitely shot in... big time widescreen format, though. Would be nice to see on a big screen, but I never have.
Is it like a 78 millimeter?
I think it's just 70.
Okay. The big shot. I don't know where 78 came from. Oh, records. That's what. Never mind.
That's a speed.
That's a speed. That's enough size. I know. Sorry.
So, do you have fun facts for this one?
Well, I think part of the reason I have such trouble with this film is because nearly 88 minutes of it are dialogue free.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
That sounds about right, yeah. And the first almost the first half hour of the film is dialogue-free. So in terms of, like, a traditional story arc where they're setting up an exposition and, you know, helping you figure things out, this movie doesn't do that. And that was always difficult for me.
Yeah, I think the first half hour can be cut out of the movie. I mean, I think part of it is just
88 minutes
the hominids don't look very convincing today. Like, it very obviously looks like people in suits.
That's quite true.
It's not like walking with cavemen.
Other things that were going on in there. I mean, they spent a lot of time and money on this film. But I think one of the funnier facts was Kubrick cut 19 minutes from the original running time to speed up the pacing. 19 minutes, really? You think that's what's going to change? I don't know.
Wasn't the last film found in, like, a salt mine in Kansas?
No clue.
That I don't know. It's not in my fun facts here.
Well,
but
it was either that or another Kubrick film where they found some of the lost footage.
Mm. That's true. Again, he paid quite a bit of attention to detail in being able to set these things up, such as, you know, can people survive in a vacuum, and do they have to have their space helmets on at those things? He actually took the time to figure those things out. He had several tons of sand imported, washed, and painted for the moon surface scenes.
Oh.
That's detail.
Painting
That's,
sand,
you know,
huh?
Yeah. And the editors of the film said something to the effect that if you actually took all of the footage that was shot, it would be 200 times the running length of the film.
Now that's epic.
That's epic. I mean, when you've got that much film that you can waste out of it, you know, that's just nuts to me.
So, Walter, you like this movie?
Yes.
What do you have to say about it?
Well,
if you're trying to convince someone to watch it,
not like it.
Yeah, it's not an everybody kind of film.
I mean, I would tell people to just watch it. It's a good movie, but I totally understand why people would not like it.
So why do you think people would not like it?
It's very long and slow.
Well, and if you're expecting a typical science fiction movie, it's not that.
Yeah, it's not even really like Twilight Zone or something. It's like intentionally supposed to be confusing.
Yeah, I mean, it even seemed like, I mean, even just reaching for a moral of the story is hard with this. I'm one of those people that doesn't really know what it was about.
Well, they made a sequel based on the sequel book, which apparently devoted most of the time to explaining what went on in the previous one, which is probably why it's not as well known.
Isn't it based on an Arthur C. Clarke?
Yeah, it was the sequel to the, well, the book was, well, the movie was originally based on the Arthur C. Clarke story, The Sentinels, and then Arthur C. Clarke wrote a book, 2001, which actually explains it, and then he wrote a sequel, 2010, and there's a couple more books, and they made a movie out of 2010. Which is not very well known today because it was not as good. Stanley Kubrick, of course, had no involvement with that. But
well, let's go on to number 9 movie. From 1963, it's Stanley Kramer's It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. I always have to count how many mads are in there.
Yeah.
Or you can just say it. It just kind of rolls off the tongue.
This has an unreal all-star cast, including Spencer Tracy, Milton Berle, Sid Caesar, Buddy Hackett, Ethel Merman, Mickey Rooney, Phil Silvers, Jonathan Winters, blah-bitty blah.
There's a lot, yeah.
I think it's really rare to have a comedy, quote-unquote, that's this kind of length. What do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to sustain comedy for more than 90 minutes is challenging.
To sustain it in most movies today for more than a few minutes seems to be challenging.
That's true.
So the basic plot here is that you have this group of strangers that hear about a treasure buried somewhere from a bank robber, and they all set off to try to get to the treasure before the rest of them. And they pick up a lot of hangers-on along the way. And in the meantime, it's all being monitored by this police officer played by Spencer Tracy.
And then he wants to get the money, too.
Yeah, because of his nagging wife.
It's the best motivation for most things in life.
This is true. So I think this movie kind of gets a bad rap these days. I think people are expecting more of a comedy about it or something.
I don't understand how they could expect more of a comedy from it.
But there's not really a bunch of laugh-out-loud moments.
There's a campy. Well, I think it's more campy than anything.
And
I thought it was hilarious when I saw it.
And it's more of a thing where, you know, you're going to see all these cameos that pop up, too.
It's almost fun to try to make sure you don't miss any of them.
Well, and today it becomes more difficult because you don't necessarily know who everybody is.
I don't know why, but I keep thinking Henry Fonda is in it.
I don't think so.
I don't think he is.
He's not, but it seems like he should be.
And a lot of the people in it.
That'd be the most miscast person ever.
Well, look at the people in it.
But he was always more of a serious actor.
And a lot of the people in it were more television-based, too.
I suppose. They made a couple horrible remakes of this, didn't they?
Well, there are movies that are similar.
I think they made a remake of it.
There's a movie called Rat Race that's really similar.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
But maybe that's part of why this gets a bad rap today, is that those other movies are not very good in the least. Jerry Lewis has a nice cameo.
Yes.
As who?
Just some guy driving a car. I don't even think he has a line.
I honestly don't remember.
Jack Benny has the same kind of cameo. My favorite one, though, is the Three Stooges.
Yes, that one. That's
literally a frame.
Yeah. They're just standing there.
Yeah. I think the problem for me was that seeing those Three Stooges shows in black and white as a child, it's weird to see them in color.
Yeah.
It almost doesn't look like them.
With the weird third stooge that you don't know who it is necessarily.
Marvin Kaplan.
That's not his stooge.
I know. They offered it to Joe Besser, unable to participate. There you go.
I've heard a story that Don Rickles to this day gets pissed because he wanted to be in this movie and didn't have a part. He'd be the only guy probably still alive.
Oh, he is still alive. Sorry, I forgot.
I think another reason this kind of gets a bad rap is because people don't believe that Stanley Kramer should be directing comedy. But that's kind of a dumb reason. So, was that one of your fun facts there?
That was one of my fun facts.
What else do you have?
Let's see what we've got there. Milton Berle's character is actually 6 months younger than his mother-in-law, played by Ethel Merman. I thought that was a funnier piece of the film, watching those two bicker through it. They filmed this in 15 different California communities. That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot of shooting there. Because of the size of the cast and comedians being bitterly competitive, they ended up putting Spencer Tracy's name as top billing and did everyone else alphabetically to forego any other problems with these crazy comics. They're not too easygoing and funny about money, are they? other things. Yeah, I mean, you know, just Ethel Merman's role was originally written as the father-in-law to be played by Groucho Marx. I did not know that.
No.
That would have been funny.
Yeah.
I like that.
Although he probably wasn't as funny by that point.
No. No. Most likely not.
There's always rumors about additional footage of this being found here and there and edited back in or whatever.
Well, yeah, it was originally 192 minutes and they cut it down. It's on the restored Criterion release of it with the white cover.
Ooh.
Well, there's another cover of it which is different, which we don't have, which doesn't have that footage.
I think it's funny that the treasure is only, okay, I say this and it sounds really stupid, it's only $350,000.
Right.
It's not like it's a million.
Right. I still want to.
But they said adjusting for inflation, it would be about $2.7 million today.
Hmm. That's a good chunk of change.
I know, right? my final fun fact, Stan Laurel turned down the invitation to be in the film because he refused to act after Oliver Hardy died.
Huh.
Wah, wah. He never performed again.
Buster Keaton has a bit, though.
That's true.
I have to watch it again and look for it.
Okay.
I really didn't know that. Yeah, who is he? Just a random dude?
Yep, towards the end of the movie.
Oh. There's so many. It'd be a great like drinking game bingo of all the people who
name
are
the
in
star.
It. Yeah, name who that is. Because I know I couldn't do it. I'm betting kids today. This wouldn't. I think Walter's an odd bird because he thinks it's funny, but I don't know that anybody else his age or younger would really get it because they don't get who any of these people are.
I don't get who most of these people are. I thought it was just funny.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is the plot, right. And then beyond that, it's fun to pick out these people, you know.
Like, would you have known those were the Three Stooges?
Well, yeah.
I mean, not that they were from my generation either, but it's still.
I think the Three Stooges are fairly recognizable still, even if people don't really know who they are, kind of like Laurel and Hardy.
Actually, what they should have done on the DVD is just have names pop up when they come on the screen, you know?
That would be funny. I thought you were going to say, like, put them all on the cover. Kind of like the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper, where you go through and look and see
you'd need a
if
bigger
you can
cover.
Figure out who think people are. Yeah, that's how they should do it. They should do a Sgt. Pepper-style cover.
So let's go on to number 8 from 1962. We have David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia, starring Peter O'Toole, Alec Guinness, Anthony Quinn, Jack Hawkins, Jose Ferrer, Claude Rains.
And his toupee.
And his toupee. And Omar Sharif.
And his toupee. No, I don't think his was. I think his was real hair.
So, Walt, can you give us a brief synopsis of this?
T.E. Lawrence is a British officer at the beginning of the movie. He's assigned to the cartography department of the British Army in Egypt. And then after the Arab revolt against the Ottoman Empire breaks out, he gets sent to Arabia to go help them. And the movie basically follows him doing just that.
So, like most David Lean movies, this has superior photography, wouldn't you say?
Yes, it looks very nice.
And musicality as well.
Yes.
Yeah, his films are generally well scored.
Yeah. Although I don't know who this person is. Music by Maurice Jarre.
Okay.
I don't know who that is. But, you know, it's a recognizable theme.
Yes.
This is a rare case where I really like the first half of this movie, but it really loses something after the intermission, I think.
No.
I've never sat through the whole thing. Which, by the way, doesn't mean I want to watch it tonight.
I've seen both of it, but I don't think I've ever seen the entire thing in one sitting.
Yeah.
However, I think part two is pretty crucial with showing... I mean, I think part two is pretty relevant today for the modern state of the Middle East and showing how the Arabs get betrayed by the colonial powers.
It is interesting how nothing really changes.
What do you mean?
Oh, I think you mean
in the Middle East.
Yeah, the idea that conflict in the Middle East, though sourced by different entities, has not really ever changed.
And you have these warring tribal things going on there amongst all the Arab factions, and you know, some of that same kind of stuff is still going on.
Yep.
So, you know, you give this a thumbs up, basically?
Yeah. But again, I understand why people really wouldn't like it, because it is pretty long.
Yeah, I had trouble just sitting through. I mean, it's very beautifully shot, but it's not a lighthearted film. It's heavy.
Well, and I can imagine this being a lot better on a big screen than on your TV.
Well, yeah, and I think there's something to be said for the fact that a little Peter O'Toole goes a long way.
This was his first movie, I believe, wasn't it?
Wow.
I don't know if it was his first movie, but it was the first one where he was, like, a main person.
It's a lot to carry for one person.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that absolutely is. That's true. I don't...
Well, yeah, he was a stage actor before that, which is why he is so theatrical, which I think works to the film's advantage.
So I've noted before that David Lean seems to have some kind of thing for trains, and there's a great train crash in the middle of this movie.
Oh, yeah, that's the one where
there's multiple.
That's one where it crashes into the desert.
They blow it up, and it kind of derails and tips over. And
yeah.
He likes blowing up trains.
Good stuff.
Or bridges.
So anything else, any fun facts there for Lawrence of Arabia?
Speaking of Peter O'Toole, he is said to have never seen the completed film until nearly 20 years after its release, but he was highly impressed by himself.
Even he couldn't sit through the whole thing.
He couldn't sit through the whole thing for 20 years.
Well, the film infamously had a rather troubled production as well. Among other things, the screenwriter Robert Bolt, who also is famous for writing the film A Man for All Seasons, in addition to the play in which it's based, he was arrested during the production participating in the campaign for nuclear disarmament, and they had to go bail him out to go bring him back to the set.
Good grief. That was only in the 1960s. another tidbit, although it is 227 minutes long, no women have any speaking roles in it.
I wasn't aware there were even any women in the film.
Uh-huh. It's reportedly the longest film not to have any female dialogue. So, I'm not sure whether, I wonder if they contribute that just to the time. I mean, Saudi Arabia still has rules about women, so.
I mean, I think it's just because it's pretty military-focused.
Well, yeah.
Well, exactly. You're not going to see many women in those situations, but.
Actually, that's something in a lot of these movies on our list here. Now that you bring it up.
Well, it's Mad World has women in it.
That's true. But many of these are, yeah, I mean, I know you hate the term chick flick and guy films, but these are mostly guy films with the exception of probably the one that you put at number one, which we'll see later. David Lean didn't see his first royalty check from this film until 1978.
I hope he filed with the Department of Labor.
I know, right? Yeah, that's very true. Very true.
Was that because they were trying to say that the movie didn't make money, or
it just doesn't? I don't
it
have
it. It definitely made money.
Yes.
So. Yeah, but studios have a tendency to do some fishy accounting when it comes to paying out people.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody got paid behind.
Any kind of percentage of the movie, they always try to say that the film didn't make anything.
Well, yeah. But
it's true.
So what number are we on, Walter?
Eight.
I have one more fun fact. You totally jipped me out of a fun fact. This was my last fun fact, and it was a good one.
Better be fun.
Steven Spielberg estimated that if the film were to be made today, it would cost somewhere around the $285 million mark.
That's
so
a
that's
lot.
Like Titanic size, Avatar size budget.
I know that Spielberg always brings this up as one of his favorites. And I heard him say something about...
That's kind of surprising.
You know, as you watch the movie, you'll see someone walk off into the desert and there's no footprints or anything, and you wonder what happened to all the other takes before that take. Do they have to go back and rake out all the sand to get rid of the footprints before shooting again, or
maybe they just did it right the first time? Or not.
That usually doesn't happen. So what number did you say, Walter?
We're on seven now.
So from 1963 we have The Great Escape, directed by John Sturges, starring another all-star cast: Steve McQueen, James Garner, Richard Attenborough, James Donald, Charles Bronson, Donald Pleasence, James Coburn, with a really good score by Elmer Bernstein. So this is a World War II film set in a German prisoner of war camp, and basically you have this large group of prisoners that's going to try to break out and kind of not necessarily get away completely, but their main goal is to just kind of wreak havoc on the German troops to distract them from other more important things.
Wasn't this based on stories from real
it
life?
It was based on the Escape from Stargluft 3, which was a prisoner of war camp in what is now Poland.
And there was a
that
book.
Yeah, okay. This it was directly based on a book about the escape from Stargluft 3.
And this is probably in your fun facts, but Steve McQueen's character is just kind of made up for the movie.
Yes.
Well, yeah, the actual historical escape didn't have any Americans participating in it because their tunnel was discovered.
And even James Garner in this movie is supposed to be in the British Air Force, I believe.
Well, yeah. Well, the historical escape was only British.
So, Walter, what do you think of this film?
It's okay. I don't think it's bad. I don't think it's particularly great either.
See, and this is one of the few World War II films that I'll actually sit through.
I mean, I think there's much better World War II films. I mean, I'll just say that.
Oh, I'm sure there's...
They do make, somehow, they're able to make digging tunnels compelling for 3 hours or whatever.
Well, they don't dig tunnels for 3 hours straight.
Well, no, they do not dig tunnels for 3 hours
straight.
It's only
about half the movie.
That's true. As a tidbit to that, the real-life escape preparation involved over 600 men working for over a year. So we complain about 3 hours of tunneling.
It seems like
they had a lot more to do.
I mean, judging by how far outside the prison camp they got in the movie, that seems like they should have gotten farther in a year.
Well, I mean, that was pretty tedious what they had to do. I mean, that was, you know.
So, Karen, would you say you're a Steve McQueen fan?
Of course. Which is probably why I liked it.
Would you say you like this movie best of his movies?
No. I still like Bullet better. But this one, I think, is... It's believable, like, I guess, to a certain degree, but...
Like when he tries to go jump the Swiss border with a motorcycle?
Yeah. I mean, that part. But hey, he actually attempted those stunts. And it was, finally, after he crashed a few times, they had a stunt double come in and do it. But he did most of that riding himself. Steve McQueen's badass.
Yeah, he does a lot of the motorcycle riding. And in fact, there's a part in here, this is probably in your fun facts too, where he passes a German on a motorcycle and the German turns around to chase him. And McQueen actually played the German part too.
Yes. Yes. It's pretty awesome. But I think for me, the person who's most surprising in here is James Garner. I was never a huge Rockford Files fan as a kid growing up. Probably because my dad would watch that and it was boring to me. But I found him to be pretty good in this. Like, I wondered why he didn't do more film.
Well, I think a lot of the movies he did do don't necessarily hold up as well. And that's why we don't see him as often.
Perhaps. But yeah, he was one of those that I enjoyed in this. So.
Did you have any other fun facts real quick?
Well, if you didn't notice, Steve McQueen, James Coburn, and Charles Bronson were also in... Name it.
Magnificent Seven.
Correct.
And only one of those guys was also in the Dirty Dozen. Charles Bronson.
That's what I was about to say. There you go. I mean, this is a really young James Coburn, too.
Yeah.
I mean, was this his first film?
No, Magnificent Seven was before
was
this.
Was before this. Okay. Only a couple years before this, huh?
Yeah.
Other fun facts to know?
What's really funny is that I'm sure there's a whole lot of people that only know Charles Bronson from things like Death Wish.
Horrible mustache.
When you go back and see him pre-mustache.
He wasn't too bad.
Didn't even realize that's the same person.
Yeah, he could actually do better acting.
You think they could ever get a set of stars, young stars, together to do a film like this today?
Yes. Young stars?
Do you think they could?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? They'd just like, take everyone. They'd take, like, Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp is older and
Nicolas
fat
Cage.
Now. Also old and bald.
Have you seen the people in this movie?
But these were relatively young, up-and-coming at the time. These are, like, the Channing Tatums of their day.
So now you have the same thing, but with older stars, like the Expendables.
Yeah, they can shove Channing Tatum in there, too.
Or do you think that today's genre has become the all-star cast superhero movies?
Yeah.
The Robert Downey Jr. Iron
Man
conglomerations.
I mean, I think they would make it more campy. Like, I could see this being directed by Quentin Tarantino or something.
Well, you had a TV remake.
That sounds awful.
Yeah, let's not even talk about that.
I think the difference in that movie is they followed some of these characters after the war was over.
Why?
Because it was on TV and they had multiple nights to... go over.
But wait, most of these people died in the film.
Well, no, a lot of them got returned to the prisoner of war camp.
Yes, a couple escaped the country.
Okay.
Including the people who row all the way to Sweden or whatever.
Which I thought was an awesome slow burn. It was interesting.
The people that try to get away the least are the ones that make it.
This film also features no female characters.
Well, seems pretty historically accurate.
So, yes, there were no women in World War II anywhere.
In prisoner of war camps? Not really.
What's the next number, Walt?
Six.
Number six we have from 1954, The Seven Samurai, directed by Akira Kurosawa, starring Toshiro Mifune.
I confuse this one.
Who's in every Akira Kurosawa
movie.
I was going to say, I confuse this one with Yojimbo.
No. That's the one. This is the one that Magnificent Seven ripped off of. Yojimbo is the one Fistful of Dollars ripped off of.
Okay, that helps me.
And this is the one that's really long.
I must not have seen this one then.
So, like Walter said, this, eventually Magnificent Seven came along and did a Western version of this, which Kurosawa made this movie as kind of an homage to Westerns. So,
The samurai and the cowboy were kind of...
Yeah.
Kinship there. Yeah.
So basically you have this poor village that's, beholden to this group of bandits. And they decide they've had enough and they hire these seven samurai to protect the village. And that's it. That's the basic plot. Oddly, this is all in black and white, which is rare for our epic format.
Although it is mid-50s.
Yeah.
So that was common for the time, but...
Yeah, it's not uncommon. It's just more uncommon for epics because you're usually dealing with big, colorful landscapes, you know. So, what do you guys think of Seven Samurai?
I think it's good, but I think it's incredibly overrated. I've seen a lot of people just think it's the best film ever made, which I really don't understand, especially in, like, more artistic circles seem to think it's really, really great, which I just don't really...
Well, there's a pretentiousness about it, is what you're saying?
No, I don't think it's pretentious at all. That's, I mean,
by the people who praise it.
Well, who praise it, it's not... I literally just don't understand why. I mean, it's not a bad movie. I just don't think it's that particularly good.
You probably have a lot of people bring it up that have never watched it, too. Because it's Kurosawa's most well-known, I would think.
I think Rashomon is probably more well-known.
More than Seven Samurai?
Probably.
I don't know.
I mean, most people probably know Magnificent Seven more, but I would say Rashomon is probably more well-known to people who know Kurosawa.
How about Pokemon?
No.
What fun facts do you have for Seven Samurai, Karen?
Well, this production company also did Godzilla in the same year, and it nearly bankrupted them.
This did, or Godzilla? Or the
both. The combination of shooting both of these and releasing them in the same year nearly bankrupted the Toho Studios. I also have that, and this one's a little more fun, there was a shortage of horses for filming this, which I thought was... kind of funny. So, but this film, outside of the horse shortage, for some odd reason, it was four times over budget. More than four times over budget. And production stretched out to 148 days. In spite of that, it is the favorite film of George Lucas.
I know that in this film in Rashomon, in order to be able to see the rain in the black and white, Akira Kurosawa dyed the water black in their sets, so you'd actually be able to pick it up on camera.
Well, that's kind of cool. This was his first samurai film.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah, I don't really know why this movie is quite as long as it is.
It is long. It is the longest film that Kurosawa did.
I would not have figured that.
Yeah. And they even cut 50 minutes off of the American distribution film.
Wow.
So, because they knew Americans, we don't sit through things.
That'd be hard to follow.
I suppose.
So obviously with that length of time, this movie becomes as much about character development and their interactions with one another as it is about action.
Yeah.
Unlike the Magnificent Seven.
That's true. I mean, but almost to the point that it's too much.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I don't really consider this a great movie. And part of it is because there's only really so much you can wring out of a plot about samurai defending a village.
Especially when...
It's not really a deep thought piece.
Especially when you see how they converted it over to Magnificent Seven. I mean, wasn't Ernest Borgnine in that?
Yeah. Wasn't he?
I thought he was.
No.
I thought he was a samurai.
Samurai?
I'm kidding. I like to confuse things. Job well done.
So what movie, or what number are we on, Walter?
Five.
At number five, from 1962, we have The Longest Day, directed by Ken Annakin. Is that right? There were several directors on this.
It was a long film.
Yeah.
Yeah,
about a long
joke.
Day.
It's the longest film.
So this also has an all-star cast. Some of the stars are John Wayne, Henry Fonda. There you go, Walter. Robert Mitchum, Sean Connery, Eddie Albert, Kurt Jurgens, Richard Todd, Richard Burton, Rod Steiger, Edmund O'Brien.
Sean Connery.
I said that.
Oh. Sean Connery. I'm paying attention.
So this movie is almost an hour-by-hour account of the D-Day invasion during World War II. What was kind of unique at the time was you actually had German actors playing German soldiers, Americans playing Americans, British playing British, French playing French.
Yeah.
They didn't really do that much before that.
It's a campy thing to do.
How is that campy?
Well, you know, it's a ploy. It's nothing.
I like, too, that they actually have them speaking in their native language, too, instead of with just a German or a French accent, you know.
Yeah, you do have to sit through some subtitles, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this was based on a book.
Of the same title.
Of the same title. What do you think of The Longest Day, Walter?
I think it's good. I think it's probably the best film about D-Day that's around there. This is much better than Saving Private Ryan, I think.
See, and I like Saving Private Ryan.
I don't.
Well, and that's not just about D-Day, though, either.
It's true.
Yeah, but it's pretty much...
Maybe that's my problem with The Longest Day, is that...
I mean, I don't think it's the best World War II film ever, but I think it's a good movie.
Despite having John Wayne, I still... I think it's historically accurate.
Yeah.
Well, and see,
it's very historically accurate. It's very location accurate as well. Having
not according to Dwight Eisenhower, walked out of the film after only a few minutes, frustrated by the inaccuracy.
I don't really
after
see.
A few minutes.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I think it's very location accurate to the countryside of Normandy, having been there before, as well as the little small towns.
And despite not having the use of computer graphics,
that's true.
They're able to do a really good job with the invasion itself and showing, you know, the great number of ships involved, as well as the landing craft and the number of people on the beach. Mm-hmm. Did you have other fun facts for this?
It had a $10 million budget, which was the most expensive black and white film ever made until the next World War II film, Schindler's List. Wow, you guys were not impressed by that at all. Sorry. Wow.
Yeah, also in black and white. So.
Although it's usually
that was the point.
Colorized
it today. It was the black and white. Yeah. Yeah.
Although this paints a bigger swath than Magnificent Seven.
It doesn't have as tight of a storyline, I don't think. I mean,
no.
Like you said, it's more of a play-by-play of what's going on.
Yeah, it's pretty much like a docudrama.
Yeah.
And you are following... certain groups of people throughout the whole thing. Especially, I think Richard Beamer does a really good job. Someone you don't see very often.
That's true. That's quite true.
And then there's this weird squadron of, like, teen idols.
I was just going to say, there's, like, that... what's his name?
Fabian
in it?
And...
the singer, who is Paul Anka?
Yeah.
What? Like,
There's probably, half a dozen of them.
Which I don't...
Salminio's there.
Yeah.
He would have never
Roddy
been allowed
McDowell.
In the military. Yeah, Roddy McDowell also would have never been allowed in the military.
Yeah. John Wayne, infamously.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what number are we on? Are we up to number four?
Yes.
So at number four from 1960, we have Stanley Kubrick again directing Spartacus. Starring Kirk Douglas, Laurence Olivier, Gene Simmons, Charles Laughton, Peter Ustinov, John Gavin, and Tony Curtis. So this basically is the story of this slave named Spartacus, who was trained to be a gladiator and leads a gladiator revolt.
Yeah, it's based on the true story of the Third Servile War led by Spartacus against the Roman Republic in about 71 BC.
Now, I've heard complaints that this is not historically accurate, but...
I mean, it's reasonably historically accurate. I mean, the real Spartacus revolt, he crossed up and down Italy for, like, three different times. But in this, he pretty much just breaks out and tries to escape by sea, which didn't really happen until the end of the revolt. But, I mean, I would say it's reasonably historically accurate.
So this is a case where the long running time helps, I think, because it really shows all the things that he and his followers had to endure.
Yeah, it was long. That's what I can say. I mean, it was a long film.
I was trying to find the time. This one says 184 minutes.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, that was long. I don't know.
Well, it does have that... opening music and also the intermission. So, Walter and I saw this in the theater. It didn't seem that long, right?
Well, kind of.
See?
Not in a bad way, though.
So. Well, yeah. I mean, I rarely think a long movie is a bad thing. So, I mean, I'm not the best person to ask about that.
There are plenty of movies that don't have a long running time that feel long.
Yeah.
That's true.
We should mention here the screenplay by Dalton Trumbo, too.
Yes. Well, the book as well was by Howard Faust.
Yeah, but this was the... Wasn't this his first film credit after being blacklisted?
Yeah, well, Dalton Trumbo was infamously in the Communist Party, and so was, the book was written by Howard Faust, who was also a lifelong member of the Communist Party.
Sounds like a good time.
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm kind of surprised this got made, because it's pretty easy to view this as an allegory for socialist revolution.
Well, and that was part of the problem that once Kubrick came aboard, allegedly had some problem over it because he didn't have any script control and he felt that there was, quote,
yeah, Kubrick,
stupid moralizing going on.
Kubrick infamously disowned this film because he felt he didn't have enough control over it.
I don't
think
he was the original director.
No, he wasn't. He was fired by Kirk Douglas, who was also one of the lead producers for it.
Yeah.
The production infamously went on for something like 10 years. It was another famous troubled production.
Yes. I don't think it was quite 10 years, but...
It was something close to, like, 10 years.
Do you have more fun facts, Karen?
Let's see. I did have one.
Where did it go?
Where did it go? Kirk Douglas described this film as a love story.
No.
I know. But
the love story was pretty distracting.
The revolt was based on a love of freedom, a love of humanity. That sounds like a bunch of BS to me, but yeah. Anything else?
You tell me.
Let's see. Yeah, that's good.
So if we go on to number three, we have from 1966. The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, directed by Sergio Leone, starring Clint Eastwood, Lee Van Cleef, Eli Wallach, and a bunch of Italians.
And if you don't know the story, you know the music.
That's for sure.
Did you say Clint Eastwood?
Yep.
Okay. Just making sure.
Wait, Clint Eastwood's in this?
I mean, you didn't know.
Yeah, the music by Morricone.
Yep. Which was also infamously... One of the songs was covered by Metallica.
Interesting.
Yeah, the song "The Ecstasy of Gold," which plays during when Eli Wallach character is running around the cemetery towards the end.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is another hunt for treasure story, although there's a lot of side adventures that happen too.
Yes.
Yeah, it takes place during the Civil War, which is also interesting because it's also becomes an anti-war film briefly.
And this was shot in Italy, correct?
Yeah, that's why they call these spaghetti westerns.
Well, yeah, it wasn't even originally released in the United States. It was only released in Italy, West Germany, and Spain.
Mm.
So you get some weird dubbing that happens. Mouths don't quite match up all the time.
Yes. That's true. But there's no, again, true to the epic, no dialogue for the first 10 minutes of the film.
What I like is you have this great photography, use of widescreen photography, but also Sergio Leone does these great close-ups on people's faces.
Well, part of that was due to the height difference between Clint Eastwood and Eli Wallach.
Ah.
9 inches difference, so it was hard for him to get them in the same frame.
Well, it's not only just the stars, you also have these close-ups on. He's able to find all these weird and interesting looking faces.
That's true.
To give in close-up.
They're not afraid to cast ugly people.
That's one way to put it.
I mean, seriously, if you look at this film, there's some ugly dudes in there.
It seems pretty historically accurate.
People were just uglier at the time.
Well, not at the time.
I think they give a good feel for what West must have been like, too. Because it always seems hot and sweaty all the time.
I suppose.
Dirty.
That's true.
So Walter likes this movie.
Yes, a lot. I would consider this one of the greatest films made.
Why?
it's really good.
Well, okay, descriptive here. Tell
well,
me why.
Well, I mean, like, it's just everything a good film, I think, should be.
Like, all the pieces coming together? Like, the story's well-written, the actors are doing well, the...
Yeah, pretty much.
It looks good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I can see how... I can see how people would think bits of it are episodic, but I don't think that that's always a bad thing.
Well, and this is one of two or three other movies
where he plays a similar character. Well, it's part of a trilogy, but technically this is the first film chronologically, and the films aren't very strongly linked together, so...
Dare I ask what the other ones are? I can't remember.
Fistful of Dollars, a few dollars more.
Okay.
Fistful of Dollars, which infamously is a ripoff of Yojimbo, and Sergio Leone was actually sued and lost to Akira Kurosawa for this.
Oh, well, there you go. There you go.
So do you have more fun facts, Karen?
Of course. As you had mentioned before, there's some wacky dubbing that goes on because the only ones speaking English in the film were Clint Eastwood, Lee Van Cleef, and Eli Wallach, with the exception of a few other little bits. But everyone else in the film is really speaking Italian or Spanish and was dubbed into English. So that's kind of weird that they let them do that, but... what it is. Orson Welles warned Sergio Leone not to make the film because Civil War pictures were box office poison. He did not listen.
Yeah, it's funny. Most people seem to complain about the Civil War sequences being totally inaccurate, but in actuality, they're pretty accurate to the real-life Confederate attempts to go seize Colorado during the Civil War.
There you go. This movie remains one of the highest-rated movies in IMDb that has not received a single Oscar nomination.
Hmm.
Huh. Although I'm sure just about everybody in it has received some type of Oscar at some point.
Good question. I wonder if they would consider it a foreign film, though.
I mean, technically
today?
It would be. Well, no, when it was released, because it wasn't originally released in the United
States. Hmm.
So let's go on to number two from 1957. We have David Lean's The Bridge on the River Kwai.
Which you'll also know from its music.
Yeah. Starring William Holden, Jack Hawkins, Alec Guinness, Sessu Hayakawa. Who else is in here? Jeffrey Horn. Again, a huge cast of people. Another World War II POW movie, but this time we're in the Far East.
Yeah, we're in Burma.
Burma. So you actually have a couple different stories here going on. William Holden escapes from the POW camp and thinks he's gotten away, but the British government actually needs him to go back to show him where they're going to be building this bridge that they want to destroy. And the other part of the story is Alec Guinness is one of the British prisoners of war. Kind of holds up discipline and honor above everything else, even in the craziness of a Japanese POW camp. And the Japanese commander there wants him to help build this bridge for the railroad to go across. So you have these stories that are going to collide there on the bridge with a train.
So metaphorical collision.
Not even.
And literal.
So, Walter, what do you think of this one?
I never seen it.
I haven't sat through the whole thing. You tell us what you think, Tim.
You guys have never saw all of Bridge on the River Kwai.
The only part I've seen of it was pretty much the very ending.
Yeah, when the bridge explodes, right?
I've seen, like, the very beginning, I think, too. But, yeah, I've never seen it.
So, you obviously have a top-notch performance here from Alec Guinness. I believe he won the Oscar.
But that role was actually offered to a couple different people.
Which is weird, because David Lean seemed to like him and put him in a lot of stuff.
Allegedly, Spencer Tracy, who said, nope, a real Englishman has to do it. And Laurence Olivier turned it down because he was busy filming Prince and the Showgirl with Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah.
Probably not a good career move.
So that's all you know about the films?
I mean, I've just seen bits and chunks of it. This is one of those things that would be on, you know, cable TV as a kid, and I just never... It just seemed long. It wasn't my cup of tea. I didn't know much about the war in the Pacific. I don't know why someone would build a bridge and then explode it. I mean, I wasn't invested in the story enough to figure it all out. So.
Well, in your fun facts, it probably says they actually blew up a train.
Yes. It cost them more than $250,000 just to build the bridge, and then only to tear it down.
Yeah.
That with a train.
This is definitely a case where the movie feels long, but again, not in a bad way. Because you're supposed to be covering a large chunk of time here.
Yes.
Enough time for them to, you know, explain the conflicts that are going on and also for them to literally build this bridge. My favorite David Lean movie, kind of king of the epics of the classic.
Okay, then.
You don't think so?
Well, again, not having seen the whole thing and feeling really connected to it, it doesn't do much for me.
So did you have any other quick fun facts there?
William Holden shaved his chest for the film. Good to know, right?
All
right,
then.
He wanted to look a little more beefcake-like. I don't know that he achieved that, in my opinion, very well, but that was the most exciting thing I could come up with for
that
you.
That was it, huh?
There's, you know, things we talked about before, but it's just, that's what it was.
Okay, so at number one, we have from director Victor Fleming from 1939, Gone with the Wind, starring Clark Gable, Vivian Leigh, Leslie Howard, Olivia de Havilland, music by Max Steiner. Another recognizable score. So this covers, again, the Civil War in a much different way than The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Well, for one, it depicts it positively. I mean, the Confederacy is depicted as good.
Like,
I
don't know about that. Those poor Southerners who are being beaten back for their...
This starts in the South and depicts the years of the Civil War and also its immediate aftermath and rebuilding through the eyes of a spoiled girl, spoiled woman, played by Vivian Leigh, who goes through, how many husbands? Three, at least?
Yeah.
And who the whole movie is whining and complaining about not being with Leslie Howard's character, which I never quite understood.
Yeah.
Would that be your choice?
No. No, not at all. I mean, this film, in all honesty, makes me wish, she deserves all of the crap that happens in her life. I don't know why people love this film and hold it up as this romantic epic. And
yeah, Tim, I don't really know why you put this as number one.
I'm going to hope it's just where it is, that it's not really number one.
Yeah, I wouldn't even put this on the list.
Oh, you guys kill me.
I know, we do.
I'm sorry if you have bad taste.
It's not that I dislike the film, but I think anytime they're trying to say that there's anything remotely historically accurate about it is pretty irritating.
You don't think there are aspects that are?
Well, I think like Walt said, that sympathy towards the South is a little bit... I mean, it's this underlying message there, you know? And it's
the beginning of it talks about how there was a great old order that was destroyed at the beginning, which is rather jarring.
And even after the war, that condescension towards, her former slaves is a little off-putting.
Well, I always find it weird that they hung around,
And in this phony that they loved her so much.
But they're probably...
You were a slave! You didn't love her!
There probably was some of that, though, of people...
Well, probably out of fear that they knew that the Reconstruction was a bunch of crap.
Yeah, I don't think there was much genuine love.
Well, no, not that, but, this inability to actually leave,
I suppose it's just... And again, I guess if it were a totally made-up story that didn't have any ties to a real thing that happened in U.S. history, then it might be a different... I might have a different tune about it, but there is something just kind of horribly wrong about the whole film.
So you don't like historical fiction?
That's the problem. It's not historical.
I think it falls on the wrong side of history, and that's my problem with it.
It would be like making a movie about Nazi Germany, and they just really tried to help the Jews with delousing, and the not bad allies kept destroying all the camps.
I think you guys need to revisit this movie.
I hate it.
Again, if it didn't have a tie to something that truly happened, I think it would be I'd be fine with it. Well, but it's hard for me to take my blinders off.
Yeah, it would be one thing if the story itself was good enough that it could stand beyond its historical inaccuracies, but I don't really find it that compelling either.
I mean, I get it. It's a story of this poor little rich girl and how life has done her wrong and how strong she is. But really, is she strong?
think she's just kind of a bitch.
Yeah, I mean, well, she's just really, I mean, okay, let's take the Civil War aspect out of it. She's a whiny brat.
Well, like, I think that was intentional, but
there are a lot of people that just see this as soap opera.
And if you did look at it like that.
Without really anything to do with the history, it just happened to fall in that time.
And I feel sorry for any dumb man who married her. Because they were dumb, too. I mean, it's...
Hey, guys are dumb. They get played all the time.
Yeah, I guess, you know, and I don't feel sorry for her when the people in her life die and leave her and treat her like crap because she's such an unlikable character, you know?
Unfortunately, she's the main one.
And I think, unfortunately, there's women out there who hold her up as some type of heroine, and... No, she's dumb. I always felt sorry for...
She's not dumb. She's exploitative and awful.
Yeah, well, I guess that's what I mean by that. But I always felt sorry for Olivia de Havilland's character. You know, what's her name? I want to call her Sue Ellen, but that's not right.
That's her sister.
Her sister.
Is it Melanie?
Yeah.
Melanie. Yeah, you feel sorry for her because she seems like the only person with her head screwed on straight in the whole film. You know, I mean, I just... I don't know. I don't like this one as much as I used to.
I mean, I don't think it's a bad movie, but I don't think it's great at all.
Yeah, it looks spectacular. The shooting of it and the sheer size of it looks spectacular.
Well, that's something that holds up.
For this time, this is 1939.
Yeah, I don't really think it's showing anything compelling, though.
But that whole, you know, that scene where she's in the Civil War hospital camp and there's just thousands of people. I mean, that mm-hmm. in itself is just huge.
They did have a lot of scope that wasn't readily available at that time. You know, like the shot you just said.
Yeah.
Any fun facts there? I know there's all kinds of casting rumors.
Yeah. Clark Gable is said to have disliked this film, saying it was a woman's picture, which does kind of go against the other films that you had on there that didn't have a lot of female characters to them. But I would almost say that this is an embarrassment to women. I think it's a good way of looking at how the world viewed women in 1939. And sadly, this character was written by a woman.
Well, and maybe that's why it kind of falls in favor in modern times, too.
Why? Because women were viewed so vapidly?
As years go on, you know, people look at it through different eyes.
And go, wow, that was wrong? I don't know. Vivian Leigh notoriously said she hated kissing Clark Gable because he had bad breath, because he had false teeth, and he smoked like a chimney. That I'd share that with you. This ranks third in the Academy Awards for the most nominated films with 13 nominations, which kind of tells you, again, the thinking of the time. But this was also one of those years where it was up against a lot of other films. Was this not the year with Casablanca?
No. Best 1940s.
Wizard of Oz.
Yes.
Okay.
Best year in film.
No.
Yeah, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Stagecoach.
No.
Ninotchka.
No.
Lots of movies.
No.
Lots of movies. The first cut ran 4.5 hours.
So they shaved a half hour off somewhere.
48 minutes, yeah. They shaved 48 minutes off of the film. Yeah, that's a lot of...
Did they just cut it out of the intermission or something?
No, I don't think so. They actually cut it. Yeah. This is ranked the number 6 greatest movie of all time.
I don't know why.
By who?
AFI. This is AFI.
No.
After the filming finished, there were 88 hours of footage.
That's a lot.
That is a lot.
That would be a long movie.
Right? I don't know. And my last wacky fact, Michael Jackson reportedly paid over $1.5 million in 1999 to purchase David O. Selznick Best Picture Oscar. Not allowed to do that anymore, are you?
No.
Yeah. And Olivia de Havilland's still alive, isn't she?
Yes.
And like living in Paris or something.
Yeah, she's lived in Europe forever.
I don't know about forever, but...
Wow. A long time.
For quite a while.
Close to it.
Yes.
So that's our list. If we go from number 10, we started with 2001, A Space Odyssey. At number 9, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, Lawrence of Arabia, The Great Escape, Seven Samurai. At number 5, we had The Longest Day, Spartacus, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, The Bridge on the River Kwai, and at number 1, we had Gone with the Wind. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to write to us at film.scene@yahoo.com. And don't forget to check us out on Facebook. We're at facebook.com/filmscenepodcast. And we're also on Twitter at filmscene1. Don't forget about our half.com store, too, for great deals on books, movies, music, and games. Click on shops in the bottom left corner and type in TGOR1. And also take a minute to rate and review us on iTunes. That's going to do it. Till next time, I'm Tim.
I'm Karen.
Walter.
Thanks for listening.